Dr. Megan Rossi, thank you so much for joining me today. Could we begin by you just explaining a bit about your background and who you are and what you do?
Yeah, so I'm Australian. I feel like I need to declare that because my accent is, yeah, slightly bogan. So I grew up in Australia on a farm, right? Aww. So that was my first encounter with gut health. But obviously back 36 years ago, no idea about gut health. But it was my first, I guess, yeah, encounter, right? And then I started working, I started studying nutrition and dietetics. And so we're learning all about the food and how powerful food was for, you know, reducing chronic conditions. But during that, I lost my grandma to bowel cancer.
Oh, wow. And, I'm sorry, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of people can relate to it. It's the second biggest cancer kill in the world, right? And that was my first conscious encounter with the gut, which is now the area I specialize in. So I hated the gut. I was like, this organ is everything I hate. It put her through the chemo, the surgery obviously took her life. And then I started working as a dietitian in the hospital setting with all different types of conditions, whether it was kidney disease, you know, heart disease, but I was also really fortunate to be the nutritionist for the Australian Olympic synchronized swimming team.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't know that.
I think because I couldn't afford anyone more experienced, essentially. So I was working with elite athletes and very sick people, yet both populations coming to me complaining of the gut. I was like, what is going on? So that's when I embarked on the PhD in gut health, looking at whether we target the gut through the right nutrition, whether that can improve the health of not just those gut symptoms that so many people struggle with, but systemically things like kidney function, heart function, and that transformed my relationship. And I knew at that stage I wanted to dedicate the rest of my career to gut health.
Oh, wow. Gosh. And were you doing that in Australia? Did you study in
the UK? So that was all done in Australia. And after my PhD, my supervisor said to me, look, if you want to really establish yourself in the research world, you need to go abroad, like, you know, go for a year. So I was like, okay. Like, Australians are so ignorant. I was like, never really had any ambitions to go abroad. And so I was like, okay, I'll go for a year. And I looked around who was doing the most innovative gut health research. King's College, you know, really caught my eye. So I was like, please, can I just come for a year? And then I got there and I was just like, wow, this is incredible. And we just got really fantastic research grants and I kind of got stuck here.
and that was it. Like, that,
yeah,
exactly. The rest is...
My mum's not overly happy. She's like, I thought you were going for a year. But like I said, just incredible research opportunities. And my passion for gut health has just been able to really flourish. It wasn't being translated to the public.
Right.
So, you know, alongside my research role, I continued working as a clinical dietitian just a couple of nights in the evening on Harley Street because I wanted to make sure my research always stayed relevant, right? And you can, I'm sure you can totally relate to that, right?
You can't lose that patient contact.
Yeah, it really, really helps you kind of relate. And I was seeing really intelligent people, right? Like CEOs and stuff, you know, who'd heard that these restrictive diets were good for the gut and they're doing all these crazy things that literally was the opposite of what we're learning. So I was like, I need to do more for science kind of communication. Obviously, you set up social media. So I was like, you know, if I get a few hundred followers. And then it was just, I think, good timing. Gut health was everywhere in the media. People were looking for a credible voice.
Yeah.
And yeah, like you've experienced, I'm sure, it just opens up doors with, you know, I've got the Gut Health Clinic, got a couple of Sunday Time bestselling books. And then,
Amazing. Yeah,
a few other things.
Amazing. So I guess for us today, it's kind of gut health in menopause, or certainly in midlife to what our I would really like to focus on, because we see so many women complaining of a few very typical symptoms. So things like bloating, increasing holding onto weight around the middle, intolerances. I think those are probably the biggest ones. And I wondered if firstly, I think they want to know why does that happen?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. And there's a number of different, I guess, hypotheses of the mechanism, right? And I say hypotheses because you're probably very aware the research into menopause, you know, is really suboptimal. And thankfully, we're getting, you know, more funding in this space and more research is being done. But if we were think about like the mechanisms of why we're experiencing these gut changes, particularly through menopause, and I think, you know, the main ones is around the estrogen and progesterone reduction, and they actually have such an important role in our gut health. And there's the three different reasons, right? So one is that our gut microbes actually are really important in regulating estrogen. I'm sure you're very aware of this, but it's just for the listeners out there to be aware.
But it's better coming from you. It's better coming.
So there's a group of microbes called the estrobilome, right? And they turn inactive estrogen. So when we have old estrogen, it gets dumped into our gut and normally we would poop it out. But if we have these right microbes called the estrobilome, they turn that inactive estrogen into active estrogen and that gets back into our blood. So actually, during the menopause, that's even more important, yeah. right, to kind of have that source. But that not only gets more estrogen in our blood, but doing so, it actually feeds those microbes a little bit. So we think actually when we start to reduce the estrogen and progesterone by significant amounts, that might reduce kind of some of the food for those microbes. So your microbes might start to change the profile and be less diverse. The other mechanisms include that we think estrogen has an important role in our gut lining integrity, kind of the strength and durability of it, right? So if you think of our gut lining, it's that we've got this 9 meter long tube, right? So it's quite this nice, stable, hollow tube. Now, our cells in our gut lining are quite, they don't really let things that are bad into our blood system. So I think this gut is a hollow, then it goes through into our blood system. So obviously it lets nutrients, but it's really selective. Now, we think with estrogen, with that reduction, it might kind of start to play a role in how good our gut lining kind of is in terms of the stability, which means that things might actually get from our gut into our blood, which could create a little bit of extra inflammation and therefore having more of a leaky gut, so to speak. And again, not all studies are showing that, but there is, you know, some studies suggesting maybe some subset, particularly those who have more symptoms, may actually be experiencing that. And then the other third mechanism, scientists here, you know, I love a mechanism, is the fact that along that 9 meters, we have all of these different estrogen and progesterone checkpoints, highlighting that these are really important in gut movement as well as gut sensitivity. So again, we have these massive changes in hormones and therefore the way our gut moves changes. Food can kind of sit there longer yeah. and over ferment, more gas is produced, as well as the fact if our gut lining is more sensitive, then what can happen is the gas can get trapped in there. Because often when we produce gas, which is normal, a bacteria, we feed them, they produce a bit of gas and many other really important chemicals. But that gas, a lot of it actually gets from our gut into our blood system. So it goes through the gut lining. But actually, if you've got a really stressed gut, what could potentially be happening is it's getting trapped in there, leading to those sensations of bloating.
It makes sense, doesn't it, that we know how sensitive bowel is to hormones, you know, constipation in pregnancy, all the, you know, all the symptoms that you get in pregnancy associated with changing hormones. So it also makes sense that your gut is going to be sensitive to declining hormones. What do you see as the kind of biggest issues? So women come into your clinic,
yeah.
I wanted, what do you see as that their biggest concerns? Because they're coming to you with their gut problem. With us, it's a kind of almost by the by, but they're coming to you with their gut problems.
So I would say bloating and reflux.
Right.
Are probably the two common symptoms of women going through the menopause where they're looking specifically at how they can control that with diet.
Okay. And what do you, so how do you reduce, how do you manage patients with reflux?
Yeah, really good one. So, and again, it comes down to understanding, I think, giving people that understanding of why that's happening. Again, coming down to the role of progesterone and estrogen in not only things like the gut movement. So if we're more likely to be constipated, what happens is that, like, you think of the 9 meter tube as like this big hollow tube. If we're like blocked up here, that can put more pressure on our stomach. And obviously, you know all this, but
this is really useful.
We've got our stomach and the esophagus, right? And you've got this little trap door that connects the two. So normally food will go in through the esophagus into the stomach and the trapdoor will shut it. So I mean, the acid from the stomach can't get back up, right?
Yeah.
But if we get more pressure in our stomach, that pops that door open and allows the acid to go up our esophagus and cause that burning sensation and then obviously the reflux. So anything that puts more pressure on your stomach essentially can trigger the reflux. And that door seems to be more leaky in the menopause as well. So things like larger meals. So what we recommend is instead of having your three, you know, standard meals, have the same amount of food, but just break it annoyingly up to like five or six. So, you know, break your lunch up 2 hours apart. So you're having a smaller amount of food in your stomach. So it's not like going to pop it open. Then other things is, again, fat. Really high fat meals can sit in your stomach for longer, putting more pressure on that door. a lot of people, again, find that caffeine and alcohol makes the door even more leaky, so they're more prone to that.
Spicy food,
And then there's, you know, we don't know any specific food that everyone with reflux struggles with, but there are a few correlations, like people typically report like tomatoes and chocolate, but not everyone. So I don't ever want someone to unnecessarily restrict their diet. So I would say do a 7-day food diary, have a look if there's any specific trigger foods, and don't cut them out completely, because I never want you to reduce down in a really significant way.
What about weight? I think it is the most Googled search term relating to menopause, more than anything else, is weight gain in menopause.
Yeah, because it can be so frustrating. I totally can understand that. And we know, again, estrogen, really important in our metabolism, but also our weight distribution, so kind of where we put the weight. So obviously estrogen is reducing, and therefore, like males, we start to more centrally gain it. And women aren't necessarily used to gaining weight in different parts of their body, usually like the hips and the thighs, which are somewhat celebrated. All of a sudden we're getting it here, and we're like, what's going on? So again, thanks to the lovely changes in hormones, but also I think annoyingly, menopause happens at the same time where we start to, you know, obviously aging, we reduce our muscle mass, that slows down our metabolism and things like that. So it can be much trickier to maintain a healthy weight. But I think one of the important things is for people to feel empowered by the science and being like, well, actually, yes, it can be harder, but there are things I can do. Same with the gut symptoms, right? You don't need to just be like, you know, I'm just going to hide myself away for 5 years because it's just a really tricky time. You know, it is a tricky time, but let's empower ourselves with the science and go, okay, well, what things can we actually do?
So that was going to be my next question. So what should we be doing for all of this? Like weights, symptoms,
Yeah, right. Well, okay, well, I guess it's...
Sorry.
So in terms of the weight management, let's kind of look at that first. So we know that actually having more plants is a really important thing for weight management. And one of the mechanisms for that is that fiber. So I think everyone hears us saying we need more fiber, blah, blah, blah. So the thing about fiber is that human cells can't digest it. Like, we don't have the enzyme. So actually, when we eat fiber from all the plants, it travels through our 9-meter digestive tract, mostly undigested, reaches the final kind of 1.5 meters where we have most of those trillions of bacteria, scientifically termed our gut microbiota. So it's those microbes that have the enzymes. They break down that fiber, and that gives us feelings of, you know, satiety. In fact, our microbes and the production of, or the breakdown of the fiber actually has been associated with increasing like GLP-1 hormone, which is obviously the target hormone for weight loss drugs like Ozempic and stuff like that. So we know our microbes are really important in things like satiety and feeling satisfied and even potentially cravings. So having more plants, whole plants, actually can be really helpful for weight management from that perspective. And then also thinking about protein, right? So we do know that we need a little bit more protein as we age. Now, I'm not saying we need to go and have all these protein shakes. Yeah. You can, a lot of people go, oh, I have to have the protein bars and all this sort of stuff. And actually, probably recommend getting it from whole foods, particularly if weight focus. So, you know, things like a cup of or half a cup of soybeans, which again, we know are important for, you know, other symptoms of menopause, contains like 10 grams of protein, right? So it's so easy from plant sources even to get the protein.
That, I think that's a really tricky one, isn't it? We were talking about this earlier, we know that we need to eat more protein, but we also know that we need to eat less meat. And so how can you kind of easily get that protein into you without, you know, meat's expensive as well as being not so great for the planet. So things like soybeans are a really good option. Anything else that's plant-based that's really high in protein?
Yeah, I would say all of your legume family. So things like your chickpeas, your butter beans, lentils, they're all a really good source. And I definitely recommend trying to get as many of them into your diet as possible. Now, I will say, if you're struggling with bloating, don't go gung-ho with these foods. And I think that's something that a lot of people, you know, they're feeling really desperate. So then they'll hear this and like, oh my God, I'm just going to eat loads and loads of plants. But actually the thing about plants is, again, full of that fiber, nourish the microbiome. But if you've gone from quite a low fiber diet to a really high one, your microbes kind of binge eat and they produce extra gas. And if you've got that underlying sensitive stomach because of all these changes in hormones that can worsen bloating. So you need to think of it kind of like training your muscles at the gym. You don't go in, you know, lift a, you know, a PB from day dot, right? You build your way up. And the same with fiber. So if you find that legume family is something that creates a little bit of extra gas, well, I would say firstly, triple rinse your tins out of the beans, because that reduces down some of the gas promoting.
I did not know that.
Yeah, triple rinse them. But then the other thing.
So what, you run them under the, you run them in under.
In a cylinder. Yeah. Just put them under. Rinse them once, rinse them twice, rinse them three times. Get rid of all that kind of that slimy bits.
Yeah.
So in terms of teaching your gut, so if you're really sensitive, I would just start with one tablespoon, but I would have it literally at lunch and in every single day. So I open up a tin and keep it in the fridge. And so just literally it's like training your gut every day. And what happens is your gut microbes actually start to more efficiently digest that gas, and therefore you don't get those, you know, burdensome symptoms.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
The other thing I think is thinking about fermented dairy. So things like kefir, actually a really good source of protein.
So what's kefir?
Kefir is similar to yogurt, right? It's like a cousin to a yogurt. It's just got more different types of microbes in it. So you can even make kefir at home, really easy. So you get the milk, add to the microbes, like these little cauliflower things, you can buy them online. And what happens is those microbes start to break down the lactose, the milk sugar. And again, we talk about intolerances. So typically kefir has less lactose, about 30% less lactose than if you're just having cow's milk, because the microbes break down some of that lactose. They produce organic acids, which is why you get a little bit of a tart taste, and they've been associated with potential health benefits. But also what happens is those microbes can turn some of the proteins into bioactives, and some of them have been associated with heart health benefits as well. So fermented dairy is a great one for the protein as well as all the kind of the fermentation benefits.
Right. And how often should we be eating kefir?
Yeah, well, I mean, mix it up when it comes to fermented foods. So I would, you know, say at least once a day, having either kefir, yogurt, you know, cottage cheese, kimchi, sauerkraut, you know, fermented vegetables. In fact, there was one study from Stanford University. It wasn't particularly looking at those in the menopause, but it showed that those who had a high fermented food diet not only had more diverse range of gut bacteria, which actually in menopause we see a decline in diversity, right? So actually that's a benefit. But also there was a reduction in some of the markers of inflammation in their blood. And again, helpful if we're feeling more inflamed during the menopause. So yeah, adding fermented foods to your diet is another good one.
So I think one of the things that we really notice is that they say, I haven't made any changes. I'm still eating the same thing. I'm still exercising the same. My lifestyle is still the same. I'm not particularly stressed, but I cannot lose this weight. How do you tend to advise those women who... Yeah. Without really restricting what they and being hungry,
yeah.
Is there any way that you kind of talk to them about how they might?
Well, I do explain the fact that yes, it is, weight management is harder. So I think acknowledging that you probably can't eat the volume of higher calorie, lower nutrient dense foods that you used to, because the hormones change and therefore your metabolism changes, your muscle mass changes and stuff like that. So I would really look at their diet and look at how can we give them that satiety effect, give them that, like, you know, I feel satisfied, but with less of the calorie dense, nutrient poor food. So things like, you know, if they're having bolognese for dinner, right, cut out half the mince for a can of mixed beans, right? Going to get loads of that fiber in there, as well as it being lower calorie, and often more nutrient dense with, you know, those extra plants in there. So thinking about, you know, hacks like that. As well as, again, spacing protein out, because what we see is when you have, you know, protein in your diet, a different meal, instead of having just one big meal of protein, actually breaking it up, because consuming protein does stimulate muscle building. So actually, instead of having just, you know, a big chicken breast at evening, try have a little bit more protein at your breakfast and your lunch and your dinner, kind of spread it across, can be another really helpful thing. And then obviously exercise is an important one. Like if we're losing muscle, we need to make sure we're still doing some resistance training, and therefore we can kind of, you know, reduce that degradation of our muscle mass.
So do you think that weight gain is inevitable?
Very good question. And no, absolutely not. But I mean, it's important so important that we accept it is tricky to maintain the weight. Right?
And it's kind of normal, right? It's normal.
Yeah, it's normal. It's very normal. But I think it's understanding that it's normal, but empowering ourselves with the science. And if this is something that's important to us, is not to gain weight, then knowing that actually there are things that you can do.
We're quite narrow in what we eat from a kind of week by week basis, aren't we? You kind of easily get into habits of only doing kind of what's comfortable and familiar, rather than like we've got, you've seen,
I did give you a cupboard a little bit of a snoop.
We've got like a cupboard full of every type of bean under the sun. Yeah. We've got spelt, we've got barley, we've got, I can't even remember the names, but loads of things on the shelf. I don't even know what to do with them. I've seen them in a recipe somewhere. and I thought, that looks great. I've seen that. That looks great, but I can't follow a recipe. So I've struggled to actually put them inside. But they've got to do be something, haven't they? And that's what we're supposed to be eating, those kinds of.
I know. And I think one of the hacks is whenever you're at the supermarket, think diversity. So instead of buying like a different pack of each of them, get the pack that's got the four different types of beans, or, you know, and you can get the cans. Don't be, don't need to be snobby and spend a day soaking them and all that sort of stuff. Get the pre-mixed grains and things like that, just to make it more efficient instead of being overwhelming. Like you're saying, go, oh my God, how do I cook this? It's going to take an extra 20 minutes. I don't have that. The kids are running around and all that sort of thing. And I think in terms of diet also, it's not just about, the general gut health, but we know that actually there has been not enough, but more research highlighting that actually it can help with reducing, some of the symptoms like hot flushes and night sweats and stuff like that by eating more plants, as well as things like those soybeans, because they contain those phytoestrogens as well. So again, thinking about food as, yes, we want it to be delicious and enjoyable, but actually making a few little tweaks to your diet might help with some of the symptoms that you feel you're so stuck with.
If you're enjoying this conversation so far, please do press the follow button on whatever platform you're listening on. If you'd like some more information, then please visit our content hub at menopausecare.co.uk. Please do share it with a friend who you think would benefit too. Supplements. So supplements is something that comes up so often. It's possibly like the number one question that I'm asked about lifestyle is like, what supplements do I recommend? So I'd love to know what you say to patients when they ask you.
Really good one. So there actually has been a little bit of research looking at things like omega-3. So ideally we would get our omega-3 from oily fish. But there has been studies showing that, having enough omega-3 has reduced some things like hot flushes and menopause. So always I'm saying like, try get your two serves of oily fish, which is, your salmon, herring, mackerel, sardines in a week. And if you're doing that, you don't need a supplement. If you aren't into fish and you can't go there, that actually is worth considering an omega-3 supplement in those scenarios.
Can you get omega-3s that are not fish based?
Yes. So algae oil.
Right.
Yeah. So if you are vegan, avoiding animals for that reason, then algae oil has got the right EPA and DHA, which are two types of the omega-3 that most other plant-based sources, so things like chia seeds, contain the omega-3s, but not those EPA and DHA, which we kind of need for things like our mental health and are more thought to be more beneficial for our gut health as well.
Okay. And any others, any other kind of mineral supplements or vitamin supplements?
Yeah, so magnesium is one that you hear a lot about in sleep, and there has been some studies looking at magnesium L-threonate, and there was one clinical trial I think from last year which showed that actually can have a benefit for sleep. Again, that one was not in people going through the menopause or postmenopausal women in isolation, so that would be an extrapolation, but I definitely know from anecdotal evidence that it can help with sleep as well. So that might be one to consider. But again, I think because there's so much else going on with the menopause, like I would try, magnesium-based foods like, the nuts and seeds maybe before bed and seeing if that helps. Because I don't want to load in all these supplements. Sometimes they can like interfere with each other. But that could be one if that's specifically a struggle of yours. So what I would do is trial it just for 4 weeks. No benefit for you, ditch it.
Right.
I think that's what we need to start doing. Trialing have a benefit, great. No benefit, then ditch it on your specific outcome if there's no strong overall evidence for it, I would say. All the studies out there is showing that supplements in the form of food is going to be much more effective than if you get it from supplemental form. So that's kind of the my typical advice. And then there's also research around phytoestrogens. But again, if you're having your tofu, your soybeans, again, the studies showing improvements in menopausal symptoms have been about half a cup of soybeans each day. Then again, you don't need to take the phytoestrogen. And in fact, in the supplement form, I think the research is a little bit more like positive studies, negative studies. So I'm kind of like, I don't really like to go down that way too much.
And spread, would you say every day, or would that work if you kind of had it a lot on 3 days a week, or how?
The
how
phytoestrogens? I mean, again, just keeping to the studies, it's daily. Mm. And I think we need to get people thinking that way to like, keep up the habit, and also to reduce gut symptoms. Because if you think of how a lot of these things work, it's feeding our gut microbiome those phytoestrogens. They're the one who turns it into kind of like those estrogen like molecules. If you starve our microbiome, because they're like us, they want to be fed three times a day. If you starve
they're alive, right?
They can actually, you know, they can also lose the enzymes to more efficiently digest things. So if you only have it once a week, like these legumes, actually you might finally get more symptoms, as well as you're having a much bigger portion. So you kind of need to think of it like your pet or a super skill or something, whatever you want to think of it, needs to be fed every meal that you're having. So, you know, whether it is those phytoestrogens or just the super six, that's kind of my nerdy self rule. Even if I'm having chocolate, right? White chocolate, no benefit for my microbiome, not even dark chocolate. I'll have a handful of almonds or bite a carrot stick. It's just that headspace. Okay. Of
that's a good idea.
Treating my taste buds, but also nourishing my microbiome, which, you know, we're discovering it's obviously hormones, it's so powerful there, but things like our mental health, you know, our heart health, all these, even osteoporosis risk, our microbiome's got a role in. All these things obviously become more important when we go through the menopause as well. So it's got far-reaching benefits.
And what about probiotics?
Yeah. So this is obviously a very big passion point of mine, because I did my PhD in probiotics, and the way that probiotics have been marketed is just not scientific. So the way they're marketed is, if you know you want to boost your gut health, or if you've got poor gut health, i.e. like in the menopause, take a probiotic, that will solve it. There's literally no clinical evidence that's ever shown a probiotic can help with general gut health, i.e. increasing microbial diversity. To improve your gut health, it's the plant diversity and the fermented food.
Right.
But that's not to say probiotics don't work. We just essentially have been using them incorrectly.
Right.
You know, all of the scientific studies out there. In fact, we have the World Gastro Organization have guidelines on probiotics, clinical guidelines, right? And it says, you know, for different indications where there's good evidence, you take this specific strain at this dose for this duration. So, for example, if anyone goes on antibiotics,
that's what I was going to ask you next. Yeah.
So the World Gastro Organization guidelines for probiotics say that you should take the LGG bacteria at 10 billion units twice a day throughout your antibiotic period. So there are these guidelines out there, Naomi, it's wild. But that formulation didn't actually exist on the market. Like, wild.
So you couldn't follow the guidelines.
So here I am, obviously doing the PhD in gut health, being a, you know, into this space, knowing the guidelines, seeing people in clinic and be like, I should be recommending this. But that strain doesn't exist on the market, which is why I developed Smart Strains, because I don't, not because I wanted to start a business, like I'm a scientist through and through, I'm a huge nerd, but there was just, the products weren't available and no company would listen to me. I was like, look, here are the guidelines, right? This is what you need to change your formula to so we can use the science. They just wouldn't do it. It is frustrating when companies target people, you know, who are going through the menopause and like make them think. In fact, there was a survey, I think it was like in 2000 people, and they showed that menopausal women were spending the most on probiotics, and actually 20% of them were spending between, I think, £350 and £500 a year, which is quite a lot.
Yeah.
Yet I think it was like 8 in 10 over the whole survey people showed they weren't having any significant benefits, right? And it's just because we're not using them the right way. Right. So like, if you want to,
so you're replacing something that could easily already be there and not replacing what's not there.
Exactly. Right. So it's kind of like supplements, right? So if you have iron deficiency, we don't go and recommend a vitamin D supplement. No. We expect the iron one. Yeah. You need to be very specific. So for menopause, kind of symptoms people experience, there is a bit of evidence for recurrent thrush as an adjunct therapy to antifungals. Having specific strains, again, it's not just any generic strain, right. Specific strains reduces recurrence by nearly 3 times right. after six months. So which they make, can be, again.
The science makes sense, yeah. doesn't it?
But again, we need to be very specific. And I think that's where my recommendations for people is, like, if you have any issues, right, and you're like, I want to try a probiotic, or a company saying, look, this is for women's health, you need to ask them, has there been a human clinical trial or a blinded clinical trial with a placebo to take out that effect? And if they say yes, like, okay, what element is it? Is it the bloating? Is it the night sweats? Like, what has it shown to have a benefit in? And then if there is a benefit in what you're after, then yeah, take it. But most cases there won't be any.
One thing that I thought that we should cover is red flags, because like with all menopause symptoms, there is always potential for them to be something else. And I think gut symptoms, particularly, women are very quick to dismiss as just constipation. Oh, just diarrhea. Oh, I've just passing a bit of blood. Oh, yeah, I've lost a lot of weight and I don't. So I wondered what your experience was of seeing patients kind of, because do they self-diagnose before they come to you? How do they come to you, and how often do you see things that need?
Yeah, it's more of just, you know, where they get symptoms and actually they do come to me because they're not sure about the symptoms. I feel people are more open about their gut health nowadays, but obviously speaking out about gut issues is a personal one, because my grandma, like, she was like diagnosed. So if she had spoken up, and she was of that older generation where, you know, you wouldn't talk about the fact that, you know, you were having blood in your stool, or that the bloating was constant and no matter what you ate, it was kind of still there. I think that's one benefit of social media, is people are now speaking up a bit more about it. But I think it's so, so important, like you said, if you're getting these symptoms, don't just, you know, go, just the menopause, right? You know, cervical cancer, all of those sorts of things, you know, bloating, you know, is one of the symptoms. So go to your GP, you know, just get some quick, easy tests, you know, don't get embarrassed. It can save lives. Like, early diagnosis saves lives. Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I think particularly, so bloating is such a tricky symptom because it's so unbelievably common, but yet sometimes it is it signifies something that is significant and needs, warrants further investigation quickly. So I guess from my perspective, it's things that don't get better, isn't it? So if you're persistently bloated and it doesn't get better after overnight, or it's not affected by what you eat, or if it's associated with other symptoms, and, you know, particularly weight loss or loss of appetite, blood in your stool, those kind of symptoms, then it is really important that those are checked out. So something that we read about more and more is the gut-brain axis, and how I understand it is that the state of your gut and your gut microbiome can influence how you are feeling in your mental health and well-being. How does that work?
Yeah, so it is this whole new world, right? And certainly when I was studying nutrition and dietetics, we got told, oh, look, diet might have a little bit of a role in mental health, but hey, let's not overstate it. Like, that's just for medications, right? And then there was this amazing study that kind of landmark for its time came out, called the SMILES trial. It was the first one that gave me as a clinician the confidence as a dietitian to actually be like, you know what, I could have a clinically meaningful impact on people's mental health via, you know, feeding them things like the Super 6, the Mediterranean diet, the oily fish and things like that. So we know diet has a huge role to play. And I think this two-way communication, you know, it's something we've all experienced through butterflies in our tummy, right? Things go up in here, we can kind of get that feeling. But like you said, it's the microbiome that's really made us go, whoa, this is a whole new level. And for any skeptics out there, because I was a skeptic, I was like, gut, brain, hippy dippy, this is not like real. There's three different main mechanisms, back to the mechanisms, how they're talking to each other, right? So one is, I liken it to the alarm system. So 70% of our immune system lives in the gut. So if our microbes sense something's going on, they activate the immune system, that produces inflammatory markers, and that can kind of tell our brain to act in a certain way. So that's kind of one, alarm system. One is like a mobile phone where the microbes literally zip messages up the vagus nerve, and that then can communicate different pathways to our brain. And then the final one is a good old postal service where the microbes actually, when we eat the fiber, they break it down, produces different chemicals. Some people are starting to hear the word short-chain fatty acids a little bit more. And some of them get into the blood system and are thought to pass that blood-brain barrier and having an impact there. So there's those three ways these microbes, very far from our brain, are having this impact.
Amazing.
And I think it is really empowering people who are suffering, you know, with poor mental health. And in fact, the stats shows 1 in 4 of us likely to have a mental health event each every year. Obviously, the menopause creates a whole kind of extra layer of complexity there, but it gives them a little bit of empowerment that actually, yes, I can't change my genetics and hormonal things, but there is some legit science showing that what I'm, you know, feeding my microbiome could actually have a, you know, really meaningful impact on my mental health.
It makes sense. Like, our brains are just chemicals, right? And what we put, and food is just chemicals, and everything that goes between our gut and our brain is just chemicals and chemical messengers and things. So it does, it make, when you think about it, it does make sense that your, that what you put into your body influences how you feel in every way, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it can be, yeah, hugely powerful. Now, obviously, mental health is very heterogeneous, right? There are some genetic factors which we can't override, and that's why obviously some people do need the medication. So no matter how gut boosting their diet is, it's never gonna really be enough. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly, like I said, as a clinician, it's given me the confidence of like, yeah, diet can be hugely powerful and something we thought only medications could help with.
And so is there any evidence that things that boost your gut microbiome kind of in addition to eating well? So would you use probiotics for your mental health? Would you use a kefir and fermented foods for your mental health? Those kind of things.
Yeah, so really good question. In terms of the fermented foods, I'm not aware of any clinical trials that have actually shown if you eat more fermented foods, it improves your mood. It might be because the studies haven't actually been done.
Right.
So I'm not aware of any negative studies. It's just, you know, hard to get funding for that sort of study. In terms of probiotics, another really good one. So there is systematic review. So they pull all the individual studies and they suggested overall certain subgroups, particularly those with more worse depression, may benefit from, again, specific strains of bacteria. But the thing about this space is that we still don't necessarily have confirmation as to which strains for which people, because all the different studies have all used different formulations. So it's a bit mixed. I would say in the next 5 years, we will have probably more understanding of actually, is it worth everyone taking it if they've got depression or anxiety? And this whole space is called psychobiotics, which has, you know, been a cool term. But I would say if someone's struggling with their mental health, do the diet route, because we have the clinical, you know, studies showing that can be really quite powerful.
Right.
And I would say in the next couple of years, we might know more about which strains potentially could be helpful.
Mate,
or whether actually it's
not worth it.
Wouldn't
that just be amazing?
Yeah, I mean, it would be. I mean, my gut, as they say, listen to that, is saying it's probably never going to completely solve it.
Mm.
But yeah, there are some promising studies that suggest it could have measurable impacts.
Wow, that would just be amazing to be able to offer that as to a patient rather than, you know, antidepressants or something. It would be incredible. We have some reader questions.
Oh, I love that.
We have Jane, who says, I have been researching the role of nutrition in menopause, and I'm also about to start HRT. How do the two play into each other, and is there one I should be tackling first?
Oh, very interesting. So, I mean, I would never ever say that someone should focus just on their diet before they do any sort of medication. I just think, you know, firstly, it's not my space, right? I'm not prescribing it. But I think as an adjunct therapy, I've seen it work really well together. I'm not sure what your take on that is.
I would say exactly the same. When you look at somebody who has symptoms, you have to look at the whole package. You can't just say, well, here, have some HRT and try that first, or try your diet and try that first. And I mean, I suppose the only time it can be useful when somebody wants reasons, and if you have somebody who comes to you and they want to know what change is causing what relief of symptoms, then if you give everybody lifestyle advice, dietary advice, exercise advice, you tell them to stop alcohol, stop coffee, and have HRT, they're not going to know.
Yeah.
But it probably is, because it's a combination of all of them, and none of them are mutually exclusive. It is about if you are, I suppose, if you're asking about the role of nutrition, is there something that you think you're not doing right in the first place?
Yeah.
And maybe just think about what that might be and fix that, as well as exploring HRT if that's what you want to do.
Yeah. As well as the fact that I'm sure improving nutrition is going to help with a lot of other factors, right? Outside of the menopause.
Absolutely. Yeah. Make you feel better.
Yeah.
And live longer and healthier in every way. Megan, thank you. That was absolutely fascinating. I loved it. Thank you. It was, really brilliant. Thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.